When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist with the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
Also, Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andy.
Today's guests on the Music Buzz Podcast are Jim Babjack and Dennis Dykin of the Smithereens. Founded in New Jersey in 1980, the Smithereens have been creating electrifying original rock and roll for 42 years. Their Take No Prisoners sound reflects their Garden State roots and has resonated with fans worldwide over the course of 17 albums and 2,500 plus shows. With the 2017 passing of their singer, Pat D'Anesio, the surviving members have persevered and carried on with their shared musical legacy, using guest vocalists such as Robin Wilson of Jim Blossoms and Marshall Crenshaw, both who have joined us on Music Buzz in the past. And they continue to entertain rock fans all over the world. So welcome to the Music Buzz, Jim and Dennis.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Hello. That sounds great. That resume there.
Yeah. You guys are impressive. I mean, you know, if nothing else, I mean, we knocked that out at the top. So, you know, we'll see you guys later.
Good talk.
So, well, what I wanted to say to both of you guys is I kind of did a dove around to listen to a lot of stuff that was, and Jim, your record that's called Buzzed Mag.
Yeah.
That I just went through and listened to the little trailers that you have on the Smithereens website. Man, that's wow, is all I can say. That's a killer record. There wasn't one thing on there that I didn't just go, oh, I love this. I hate everything. But it's great.
That's great.
No, it's killer.
That's great.
And Dennis, you're playing drums on it too, right?
I think I'm not on all of them, but I'm
not on all of them?
Maybe most of them. A third or a half, something like that.
Well, the production sounds great. Sonically, it sounds wonderful. The tunes are great. I can't wait to get it. I mean, I want to hear the whole thing. Our listeners need to check that out. Jim Babjack's Buzz Meg. And Dennis, I checked out your stuff too. Your bell sound stuff, Bear in My Garden. Great, man. I love it.
Thank you very much.
I love the long coda at the end. It just keeps growing, and it's really cool.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
The bell sound stuff, I listened to, I found a couple other songs. Standing in That Line, very kind of Pet sounds, Beach Boys-y. Great, man. The Sun's Gonna Shine in the Morning. Mm-hmm. Loved it. Great songs. Thanks. Everybody should be checking these out, Dennis Dykin and Bell Sound. And the other thing that I really dug, because I did a record in 2020 that was Songs from Isolation. It was about the pandemic, during the pandemic. It was kind of a musical about the pandemic. And John Sebastian was played on four songs. So somehow the Butchie's Tune thing came up. Man, great job on that. Nice.
Thank you. That was one of the great moments of my life, really. It really, truly was.
Of course it was. I mean, John Sebastian's right there next to you. I mean, it looked really great. I mean, it was very cool.
That song is one of my favorite songs of all time. And to have the opportunity to do it in that setting was mind-blowing. The other real cool moment during that show was getting to play Washboard with John Sebastian.
What song was that on?
Well, It's Not Time Now.
From the Daydream record, yeah.
Is that part of your normal percussive arsenal, or is it something you just naturally had an affinity for?
Well, you know, Jimmy and I had a jug band in high school, along with Mike, our bass player. I used to go to Sam Goody's and buy cutouts. Sam Goody's was an East Coast record chain.
Yeah, I know it.
Yeah. And they had sometimes like records for 49 cents.
I bought a lot of them like that.
Right. And that's, I discovered the Jim Queskin, the first Jim Queskin jug band album, which I just love. And I found that it was easy to get into because I was really, really steeped in the Spoonful. So I wanted to hear from whence that came. So obviously Jim Queskin, you know, appropriating the same roots, but I did find another LP at the library in Carteret, New Jersey, called Jugs, Washbands, Washboards, and Kazoos. And it was an RCA compilation that had the real deal, like the Memphis Jug Band on it. I'm not sure if Gus Cannon was there, but I just eat that stuff up. I love it to pieces.
Did your band have a single string bass?
No, we didn't have a bass. Mike played spoons at the time.
Okay, cool. In the 60s, I was a huge fan of Spoonful and the Zombies, almost as a match set. They were both speaking to me at the time.
Oh, yeah. No argument here where those two bands are concerned. You know? Not at all.
It would appear a faint affinity for, what's their name? The Beatles.
The Ruddles. Yeah.
Yeah, man. You guys... Not to dwell on this because it's such a, you know, it is obviously a tangential work of love on your part, but I listened to and meet the Smithereens and wow. I mean, it was really good. I love Don't Bother Me, This Guy. It Won't Be Long. That was really good. Those tracks really spoke to me, but you clearly love those guys. And it shows in your harmonies too, on your own music.
And, you know, I love mono mixes. I really do, but I also... I'm not a purist. I love the stereo mixes as well. That's where we learned to sing harmony, to pick apart isolated vocal tracks or learn to play guitar licks or drum feels. You know, it was from the stereo recordings where you could really delve into.
Drums were over here. Yeah. Made it easier to hear that stuff. I was really impressed with the Lost album. I went through and listened to as much of that as I could today. There's not a bad song on there. So I want to encourage our listeners to check this record out. Right off the bat, Out of This World, killer. Loved it. Don't Look Down had kind of a Nuggets kind of a groove to it. Nice riff. A World Apart, you know, and I love the way, and you guys have always done this, where you'll do something kind of heavy and dark and then something kind of light and, oh, okay, take you back to a different place. And A World Apart does that on there. And the major, I love the bass, just walking down the scale in that one section. And then going into Stop, whoever organized the record, going into Stop Bringing Me Down, which is the heaviest tune on the record, and maybe my favorite one, because that kind of rolls on longer than you guys usually do. And, man, it's cooking. The last couple minutes, you guys are just, you know, sounds like you had a couple beers, and let's just beat the shit out of this thing. Yeah, it's really great. I love it.
We did have beers, yes.
We did have beers. Well, good. And then after that, and it took some balls, and I saw, oh, Monkey Man. Oh, I wanted to, is this the, yeah, but it wasn't. But it's a smoking hot tune. I love the riff. It kind of reminds me of, the first thing I thought of was the Lola versus Power Man record, the heavy tunes on there that Dave did, which I'll come back to.
Huh? Like Rats.
Rats or Power Man, yeah. And that song holds its own against the other Monkey Man for sure. It's really great.
So the Lost album was recorded in 1993, correct?
Yep, that's right.
And I was reading about it too and listening to it. Take us back to that time a little bit. Like, have you revisited that over the years? Like, oh yeah, I go back and listen to it? Or was it one of those things you came back to relatively recently and just kind of rediscovered yourselves? Was it one of those things you always felt like you had in your back pocket kind of thing? I'd just love to kind of hear the, you know, just kind of your process with it over the years, you know, as it kind of sat out there and you obviously knew about it, but it was, you know, kind of in the drawer for a long time, right?
Well, there are a lot of tapes that we have. So it wasn't really a back pocket thing. Dennis, I don't know when we started talking about it. I suppose it was after Pat passed away. because I was looking at my old demos also, because we're going to start working on a new album also with Robin Wilson and with Marshall Crenshaw. You know, as far as melodies and songs, yeah, we have them in our back pocket. They just need to be finished. And then I discovered this tape, and I called Mike up and Dennis, and Dennis had the original DAT tape for it. So, Dennis, you want to continue this thread?
When we cut this batch of songs in 93, we were between labels, and we were self-producing ourselves. And we had a lot of material. We actually recorded two albums worth of stuff. And we, after we finished this particular project, fairly soon after that, we signed with RCA. So we had to decide what material we're going to record. And 12 of the tunes that we had cut during this period of the Lost Album ended up being re-recorded for our LP, A Date with the Smithereens. We did that in late 93. It came out in early 94. So these were, you know, you could call them leftovers, I suppose, but...
I like leftovers.
I'm going to have some for dinner.
We just virtually heated them up.
That's what I mean about having them in your back pocket. And I know you said no, but they're so good. I'm kind of like, gosh... You know, where were these? Did you guys just completely forget about it? You know what I mean? Because they're so good. So that's why I kind of was curious.
We do have a lot in our archives, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. But that was probably the most realized of the unreleased stash. All we needed to do was sequence those tunes, master them, come up with a cover. You know, and Mike wrote a really, I think, poignant essay. That's in the package too, that it captures the mood and the conception and everything about that record. I highly recommend people read his essay in there. It's very, very good.
Is that on your website too, when I was reading, or is that just a small part of it maybe?
Small part of it, I think. Yeah, it's inside the booklet or the inside the CD gatefold. Or whatever you call it.
Yeah, it's interesting too, because you think back, you know, to 1993. I mean, as we all remember, the amount of music that was being released during that time, and the quality was so amazing, right? I mean, early 90s through mid 90s in particular. For those of our listeners that may be younger that weren't around at that time as much, I mean, the Smithereens, you guys are a band that was, even Kurt Cobain said he was influenced by you guys.
Right.
How does, you know, you hear something like that, I mean, I'm not surprised by it, especially when you hear your tunes and hear Nirvana. But as time goes on, I mean, you guys have got to look back, and when you hear stuff like that, you got to pinch yourself a little bit, right? And just that kind of influence that you guys had on somebody that's had such worldwide phenomenon, if you will, as Nirvana was and Cobain was. Did you guys have any relationship there at all with that band?
Only with Butch Vig, because before we left Capitol Records, Butch Vig was telling us all this, and I had never heard it before. So he was telling us that during Nevermind, they were A-B-ing our records and trying to get that guitar sound that I had. And we used Butch Vig for a Christmas song. One of the last things we did for Capitol Records was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, a promo radio thing, which I hear in the supermarkets around the holidays. So we were kind of testing Butch Vig out, because he was considered to be our next producer. Yeah, it all was great until, you know, we parted ways, and then we never got to work with Butch.
Well, no, we never did cross paths with Nirvana. We never met. But we were delighted to see that in his own handwriting that was reproduced in, I guess, his journals, that he talks about listening to us. I think there was a mixtape or a list of song records he was listening to, and Especially For You was among them. It's almost hard to fathom that we are the band that some people are citing as influences, or that we have so much meaning in their lives. I know it's real, because we meet these people and they very sincerely express that to us. But when you're in the eye of the storm, you know, it's not always, like Jimmy says, you go to the grocery store or you go to the post office, you're just doing your daily thing, and then you stop and you meet somebody and they tell you about, and I'll tell you, so in the New York, New Jersey area, we have a bunch of drummers get together. And Dane, if you're ever in town, well, we do it in Zoom. You could join us if you want to join the Zoom. We used to do it in person. I'll get your email and I'll put it on the chain. So we get together. It was in person for up until COVID. And we'd just go to lunch and BS and talk about our careers or lack thereof. And there's a younger guy, RJ Rabin is his name. He's a great drummer and a fabulous dude. And I don't know, he might be 10 years younger than me. And he reveres me so much just because of the Nirvana connection. Like he's a good friend of mine, but still he has this certain sense of awe when yeah, we sure. talk. And it's funny because I hardly ever think about that aspect of our sphere of influence. You know?
That speaks to your character too. I mean, you're too busy, yeah. you know, and there, like you said, there are two levels. There are the people that find your music and it has meaning to them as listeners, but it must be exponentially more gratifying to not only find that some of those people are notable musicians, peers, and supergroups that have listened to you and been influenced by you. That's a whole other step, is being the influencing factor in a notable band. That's got to be so gratifying.
Well, it's super cool because we grew up as fans and we're still fans, you know, and we cite our influences and I still listen to records that always turned me on to inspire me. And to think that I know that people are doing that with our records, that's what it's all about, you know, and that's so meaningful. And that's, yeah, it really is full circle.
Speaking of just that, you talk about the influences, and I'm sure with your type of music, it's vast and probably too big a question to say, who are your go-to bands? Clearly Beatles, Beach Boys, you know, Spoonful and so on. But if you were to give me kind of a smattering of the people that really do speak to you consistently from history and current.
Everything.
Yeah.
Everything from Prez Prado to Johnny Cash to, you know, when we were growing up in the 60s, AM radio was so wonderful. You had, you know, you had country, you had surf music, you had the British invasion, you had, everything was great. Everything I heard as a kid was, I loved. And so it's really, really hard to put a finger on it. My dad played accordion when I was a kid, and my parents are Hungarian. So we'd go to these Hungarian dances and there'd be Gypsy Joe and his orchestra playing. So I always loved music, just, you know, and that's how it started.
That's almost a Beatle answer, because when you listen to what the Beatles say, they listen to, you know, Formby, George Formby, you know, singing naughty songs in the 40s to the troops. Hence, When I'm 64, songs like When I'm 64, you know, it's just, that becomes almost an offshoot of that style of music.
Well, Ray Davies copped a lick off the guy, too. I mean,
yeah,
well respected man.
And in the 1970s, in the New York area, there was a revival of 50s music. So at Madison Square Garden, they would have Jerry Lee Lewis, Chuck Berry, you know, and they had these big shows. And so I went back started listening to Buddy Holly and Elvis and all that, the older stuff. So we really got a good education there, a good foundation for songwriting and for playing and where things came from, you know. And
so
Dennis
important.
And I, Dennis was my, when I first met Dennis, we were freshmen in high school, and this goes back to 1971. And at that time, I had maybe 10 records. But Dennis turned me on to so many different types of music and bands. And then we lived so close to New York. We were only 20 miles away where we grew up. And we used to take the bus in the summers into New York and go record shopping in Greenwich Village and all over the place. And that's how we ended up with our collections at the time.
You know, you just go on kicks of listening to some of your favorite stuff. I've been on a real Gene Pitney kick of late. I really just worship some of his records. Like It Hurts to Be in Love and I'm Gonna Be Strong, 24 Hours from Tulsa, you know, because he had great writers, Bacharach David and Neil Sedaka, all the Man and Wild. And I really love the Jive Five. I just love the Jive Five. What time is it? My True Story. I'm a Happy Man. These are just things. The Skyliners are really big with me. Since I Don't Have You was their big hit, but they made another record called Lonely Way, which you may or may not know. No.
Did Guns N' Roses remake that song that you mentioned?
I think they did. Yeah, which is they a did. Really odd,
right?
An odd, odd choice.
Yeah.
Great you song. Guys both. Do you still have your record collections?
Sure, absolutely.
Me too, man. Except the ones my kids have gotten a lot of the good ones, but
yeah.
When everybody else was getting rid of their stuff and look at these CDs, man. I'm going. I'm hanging on to mine. I had 3,000 at one time.
I still probably have them, and even the CDs too. I
got them too, man.
Didn't give up anything.
Never. Nope. When all that digital stuff goes away, I still got the hard copy over here.
There's a new artist called Nick Frater from Britain that I really like. I can go on, we could do a whole podcast about this, the records that we love. Matter of fact, I do have a weekly streaming show on WFMU.org, and I just, play all the stuff I dig. So, WFMU.
Well, I got one thing I want to mention before we go any further is, my favorite band. I mean, this is what a nerd I am. I've got Kinks dolls next to where I mix records here in my studio. So I got Ray and Dave, and one of them's sour and one of them's happy. Imagine that. So Dennis, you played that one gig that those guys did together in London. Just tell me about what that was like when.
Well, before that, the Smithereens played with Ray and Dave in 91, I think it was, November of 91.
On the same bill.
Which we were playing a benefit at Boston Garden for WBCN and some charity. And we got word that Ray and Dave were going to be on the bill. And at the time, they were promoting the Phobia LP. And it was just the two of them doing an acoustic tour. So we offered our services, and lo and behold, they said yes. So we actually got to play It Really Got Me with them that night in front of this 20,000 seat venue. That was extremely important to us and kind of life changing.
But other bands like that are worthy of adoration. I mean, like the Beach Boys and so on.
The Bo Brummels. We were the Bo Brummels twice, right, Dan?
Yep.
Really? Right. Was Sal singing?
Yep, yeah. Both times. Oh, yeah.
No shit. Was Ron Elliott playing?
No, Ron Elliott wasn't there.
One of them, Ron Meager, and the other one was Deck Muck. One was in 1985, and the other one was in the year 2000 at Cave Stomp, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, they made some really indelibly great records.
I love the later stuff. I love Bradley's Barn and Triangle are my two favorites that they did. The early stuff's good too. Triangle's fantastic.
So we used to play some of their songs in the early days before we were signed, and people thought they were original songs. We used to do Don't Talk to Strangers and Sad Little Girl and... we didn't do the hits. We did
a song called Can It Be, which is a really cool Brummels tune.
Yeah.
That's from the early stuff. Yeah, that stuff's great, man. When you guys played that gig with the Kinks in the early 90s, did you do any of that stuff off the Phobia record, like Hatred? No. Or none of that stuff, Scattered?
No, what happened is they did, the plan was we met with them at Soundcheck. They were going to do their entire show, just the two of them. And there was a shared backline for all the artists there. And there was a curtain. So we set up behind the curtain at our instruments. And the plan was when they got to the end of Lola, the curtain rose and we did the coda of Lola. And then You Really Got Me.
Is that recorded?
It is. Yeah. Matter of fact, that version of You Really Got Me appears on a compilation called Attack of the Smithereens on Capitol.
Well, that's a good segue to my next question. You guys were pretty kind of personality driven. You had some nice kind of overlaid kind of band photos on the covers of your albums, which was very in vogue as we transitioned from 70s through the punk era and into the 80s. Then suddenly out of nowhere, we've got Blown to Smithereens, which is a cover I might have done. I love the boots and the smoke. That is conceptually very different from everything you've done prior to that. And then I started digging deeper and seeing Attack of the Smithereens, which almost felt like Mars Attack or Zappa's Weasels Rip My Flesh. There's something really bizarre and cartoonistic at the same time. And then the anthology covers, they all suddenly became very conceptual. How did that happen? Are you guys hands-on with all of your work from the original sort of band photos through to these? Or did you kind of get ideas thrown to you by the label and you would just cherry pick your favorites?
It's always been down to us, but I would say with Especially For You, I don't like that album cover. I'll go on record saying that, but what we provided to Enigma at the time was an image that eventually turned up on a picture disc of Especially For You, kind of a garish, ghoulish, very colorful piece of artwork. Enigma thought it would discourage impulse buying. And you know what? They might have been right. So what they did is they just excerpted a little chunk of that artwork and turned it into what looks to me like a very bad 80s greeting card.
First of all, it's a bit confusing. I mean, it's one of those covers that you might have bravely done after being hugely established, or it's a very jazzy cover. I mean, it's a bit confusing in terms of genre. It feels jazzy and certainly a little psychedelic, but I get a jazz vibe from it, and it's nowhere near as committed as a cover as the Blown to Smithereens cover. I mean, that was brilliant. I thought that was a great, great cover.
That's one that was done by Tommy Steele at Capitol.
Dear friend of mine. I worked with Tommy on Megadeth, on so many projects when I lived in L.A.
Are you in touch with him?
I was with him when he was working on his Thai books. Power was kind of leaning and going kind of, I don't know if they're still in that tower. I don't think Capitol is it?
I think to some degree they are, or it's Universal. I don't know.
You believe he went on to other pastures. I don't know if he went independent. It's one of those things where when you go to that floor, that art floor, and talk art with Tommy, you know, it's a 3 or 4 hour visit. I'm ashamed to say we haven't stayed in touch. So Tommy, if you're listening, call me.
But, you know, apart from Blown To, I think pretty much every other, and not Attack, but I think both of those are exceptions, but I think the rest of our catalog, I think the concepts came from within the band.
But were executed through Tommy, yeah?
Capitol years, yes. Uh-huh.
Well, the Blow Up album was done by Saul Bass.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Pat and I were talking about the movie posters he did, and then we looked in the phone book, and he was in the phone book while we were recording not far away from there. We were at what was A&M Studios, the old Charlie Chaplin Studios, but nearby Pink's Hot Dogs.
I looked them up yesterday to show my daughters. They started in 1932. Pink's on the corner of La Brea and whatever, La Brea. And
you know, it's funny. One time Dennis and I were in there, and we had an autographed photo that used to be hanging in there. We were sitting right there having hot dogs, and people next to us were talking about how they said something about, oh, wow, that's the best one here, that those autographs of the Smithereens, and they didn't even recognize.
And you guys are sitting right next to him having a dog.
Do you remember that, Dan?
I do, yeah. There's been a few moments like that. That's pretty funny. Yeah,
so, you know, we called Saul Bass from the phone book and just, you know, entertain the idea of him doing an album cover. And I think he only did one or two before that, Frank Sinatra and something else. But he agreed to do our cover, which was amazing.
Hey, a gig's a gig, you know?
Yeah, right?
I called Marshall Arisman, a painter who I greatly admired one time, and with the remote hope that he might provide a cover. Because I don't normally art direct other people's art. I do my own images, but I got so busy at one point, I was working with a band out of Holland called Skew Siskin. And I remembered Marshall's kind of portraits with these crazy metallic beaks. And Skew Siskin means crazy bird. And I thought, bird, I'll call Marshall and see. Well, he graciously did a project for me, for a cover for me. So you're right. If you have the notion to pick up the phone, sometimes you're delighted with what happens.
The other interesting artist connection we made was with Jack Davis, who did so much for Mad Magazine. And he did our B-Sides The Beatles cover. I think it was one of the last, if not the last, album cover that he did before he passed. He had done, actually in his career, he had done quite a few album covers of note. Best of the Cow Sills, he did a Johnny Cash cover, Bob and Ray. He did a number of them, but we were tickled pink to have him do one for us.
You had a subscription to Mad?
No, I went to the store and bought them.
Nice. There, yeah, very cool.
I have the cover right here. Yeah, we have great hair again in this one.
Came back. Wow.
You guys do realize that Indiana is the home of the Four Freshmen, right?
I did know that.
One of my favorite musical entities of all time.
Incredible influence on Brian Wilson, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brian has a great quote. You know, Brian was born with a gift, of course, and his talent was always there, but it took the Four Freshmen to bring it to the fore. He had a great quote. He said, "The first time I heard the Four Freshmen, something magic happened inside my head." And just hearing them unlocked all that, you know? Yeah. But the Freshmen continue to be a real inspiration to me and on so many levels. And I think that the world needs to listen to them more. There's a real calming and effect they bring. And there's such a deep sense of beauty to what they did. So that's what I think of when I think of Indiana.
Not Indiana Wants Me.
Lord, I can't go back there. Well, Dennis, in the way you're speaking of these bands, it doesn't surprise me that you've done liner notes too, right?
Right, I have, yeah.
For which Beloved Spoonful project?
Oh, which albums? I did for Daydream and Hums.
Nice.
Notes for those. And I got to say, John Mellencamp did the induction to the Hall of Fame.
Yes, he did.
And I got to say, his speech was so right on. I don't know. I couldn't have conjured anything better than that myself. It was just so from the heart and so just right on. He really got that band. And,
oh, he's a super fan of those guys. Yeah.
And would never have guessed it, honestly. And I was delighted to see that he was and to what he did for those fellas. That was super magnificent.
John was delighted too.
We had a couple of guests on our show who I'm almost positive you guys are fully aware of, and one was Van Dyke Parks, mm-hmm. and he's a pretty special guy. And Roger Manning, Joseph Manning Jr., also from Jellyfish. And whenever you hear that music, you know he's completely immersed in the layering of Beach Boys, that style. Are you guys fans of those guys, or are they just too?
I recently listened to that. I guess they did a Stack of Tracks version of Jellyfish. Greg, have you heard that? It's pretty stunning. And Van Dyke Parks, without a doubt.
Surf's Up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that. And I really like Song Cycle, even though I got to be in the mood to really lay into it. But I think it's great that Brian latched on to him. That Brian Wilson touched on.
You're the only other guy other than myself that I know of that has ever even listened to Song Cycle.
Oh, really? You got to be in the right frame of mind, so I think. I don't know if you agree.
I agree.
But, yeah.
I remember getting it. I couldn't ever get through it when I was young. But then I learned how, as time went on, the first Randy Newman record was tough, too, for me. And then it grew on me, too, but, you know.
Not for me. Randy spoke to me from day one. I loved him. I still don't.
And I read somewhere where Sal Valentino dummied the vocals for the first Randy Newman record, so because Randy wasn't comfortable singing yet, and then he learned how to sing. He did his versions of Sal singing those songs because he
was in that for the first album.
Yeah, he was in that loop with those guys period of time. I remember reading that somewhere. I don't know if that's true or not, but isn't that if that's true, how wild is that?
I got to look into that. Friend of mine that used to be Randy's archivist, so he might know, or maybe he might have tapes of that.
I would love to hear that, man.
Yeah, so would I.
You mean the Randy version?
I'd like to hear the Sal Valentino.
No, I want to hear Sal Valentino sing that stuff, man.
You could do like a Nilsson Sings Newman version of that album with Sal.
Come on, I'll buy that one.
It always amazes me when I hear how certain musicians like Reginald Dwight. He didn't like his own voice, but as you look back over his music, anytime American Idol had an Elton John week, everybody sounded like a Hollywood in lounge act trying to cover an Elton John song. It just doesn't work. Only Elton sing his songs well. John Lennon didn't like his own voice, which makes no sense to me. Yeah, there's so many people that are so good at what they do. They've got the only voice right. And Dylan's a bit more obvious, but it's still.
I got a quick question for Jim. I just got to make sure this is right. So you did music for soap operas, The Guiding Light and Passions?
Yeah, some of those songs that are on the Buzz Meg record, Lost in Love. And another one, I was hooked up with a programmer there, and he liked my stuff. So he would use it. He used it maybe 10 or 15 times, you know. And it was in the background. But anyway, it helped me in those years financially.
I would assume so.
Because
those are good paychecks.
Yeah, we weren't doing much at the time, you know. So, So that's how that happened. It's all who you know, really. Mm-hmm. And then the soap operas died out, and then the whole thing died out.
Now, what about
it was good while it lasted, right?
Well, speaking
where Buzz Meg came from, that title.
No, not at all. I just, it was kind of a joke. I'm Hungarian and I speak Hungarian with my parents to this day. Buzz Meg spelled differently. It's in English, it's phonetically spelled. It's not spelled like that in Hungarian, but it pretty much means fuck it, fuck you, or like you could hit your hand with a hammer and say, oh, Buzz Meg, you know.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Or like,
damn it. Yeah.
But it does mean the word buzz means to fuck in a past tense.
Have fucked.
Well, really glad I am.
Right. I'm going to start using it.
Yeah. Buzz Meg. Buzz Meg. Yeah.
You mentioned your dad was an accordion player, right?
Well, not a great one, but yeah.
But he recorded or he played on his own? Did he ever record?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, they just drank.
That's okay. Whatever brings you together.
Yeah. They would do all Hungarian folk songs and stuff.
I want to ask this only because accordion is the instrument of the owner of the music store where we used to always rent equipment when we were 12 and 13 years old and aspiring musicians. From Neil Peart, from Rush, bless his soul, and us, we all grew up in the Niagara region, and a guy called Walter Ostenek kept winning Grammys for being the best polka accordion. I'm just curious to know if your dad ever stumbled across
Walter. No, but what's interesting also is that my dad made me get accordion lessons when I was 7 years old. Mike, our bass player, also was taking accordion lessons at the same time because his parents were Hungarian too. So we had the same teacher at the same time, and Mike and I went to the same church. So we had our communion together in 1964. Mm. So that's how far we go back.
Wow, that's
and
great.
I think it gave Mike a good foundation for playing the bass, you know, learning to play the bass notes on the left hand with like a piano. So I think that kind of helped him, and it probably helped me also with melodies. It had to have helped somehow. By 1968 I got my first guitar, and in the interim I also played violin from 66 to 68, and then I finally was able to get a guitar. My parents would not get me one for the longest time.
Was it conservatory violin, or did you happen to find people
it was just through school. It was an after school program kind of thing.
Scales and little melodies and
yeah, pretty much, you know. And then I taught myself how to play Edelweiss from The Sound of Music.
I played that on piano.
I was actually born in Salzburg, Austria. So I had this connection with that movie and Mozart and everything. And I like, okay, I'll give that a shot.
So how about the coffee business? How'd you end up in the coffee business? I saw that.
I have a friend, a fan of ours, who's been a fan since the 80s. He's a coffee roaster. And about 6 years ago, I said to him, can you make me a... It started out as kind of a lark. I said, can you make me coffee blended with bourbon? See how that would taste? And he said, sure, I'll give it a try. It was okay. But then he said, I'm going to try something else. And he made something with a rum infused flavor. And I'm like, wow, this is really good. Mm. So then I was thinking, oh man, you know what? I used to own a record store in the early 80s. And so I thought, now, how cool would it be if I opened up a coffee shop that sold vinyl records?
Yeah, there you go.
And then I thought, I'm getting too old for that kind of crap. And I wouldn't have time because, you know, we're busy with the band, But anyway, it turned into just an online thing. So I incorporated 5 years ago, I think 2017. And I only just started to sell the coffee online last month or 2 months ago, because, you know, things just get in the way. And plus, you know, when I got the LLC, the corporation, that minute, somebody already took the domain name. And I'm like, damn. So then I had to be careful of what I did first, you know, like, okay, I had to, you know, it was just crazy, the trademark. And so it took 5 years to get to that point. And I'll be lucky if I could sell enough to make grocery money every month. But you know what? I love the coffee, and people that have tried it have loved it. So it's just going to be a thing. It's just a side thing.
So akin to hard lemonade with vodka or whatever, yours is a hard coffee?
No. It has, you.
That's damn just it, one I was going to start drinking that every morning.
No, that's just one of them. And then we could always add to it.
I'm thinking that's a brilliant idea, is coming up with a range of hard coffee. People often do like a little cognac in their coffee with a cream, with a clotted cream in England, for example. So yeah. If you were to have a range of hard coffees, that could be a brilliant range. You know,
I don't think it's possible unless it was cold brew or something. Mm-hmm. And then
now, cannabis coffee could be a thing. Mm-hmm. I was just in a store passing through Illinois yesterday, and now they have some kind of drink. It's like an infused, like a soda that you can get stoned from. It's like, wow, I wouldn't think they would have come up with that, but why not? Hey.
So did you study piano at all? Apart from.
No, I have a piano in the house, but I. No, I'm not. You know, I could play on my own songs if I need to add something to it. But as far as, no, I'm not very good at that. No.
Have you used accordion notably in any of your own songs?
No. The accordion I had, my dad lost in a poker game when I was a kid, so I never saw it again.
There's a song in that.
There is a song there.
Yeah. My dad also had in a poker game, he won a Hawaiian steel guitar.
Wow.
I remember it was 1963-64. And I would just doodle around on that. And then one day it was gone. I'm like, Dad, what happened to that thing, that Hawaiian guitar? I didn't know it was called a Hawaiian guitar. I didn't know what it was. And he said, I lost it in a poker game.
Oh, man.
He won it. And then
easy go, I guess.
Yeah. Did it come with a slide? Were you aware that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, I must have sounded like doo-doo, you know.
Well, yeah.
But I was experimenting. And as a matter of fact, when I first started playing guitar, my dad came into my room and I was just fooling around. And he says, because this is when I just started. And he says to me, what are you doing? And I said, I'm trying to write a song. And he says, son, you have to walk before you can run, meaning I have to learn how to play other songs first. And I said, no, that's not what I want to do. So in my head already, I had this thing where I want to play what I want to play.
Right.
You know, and then the guitar teacher was teaching me like Mary Had a Little Lamb and stuff like that. And then I'm like, fuck this. You know, So I got my record player, putting the needle back and forth, you know, till I learned how to play the intro to Ticket to Ride. And then, you know,
good for you.
That's how it started.
One of my sons is taking guitar lessons right now. I kind of had that conversation with you the other day because he's getting to the point where you can tell he's like, yeah, we're playing these same songs over and over. And I said, well, maybe you just should go in there and tell him what songs you want to play. You know, he's
like, well, on top of Old Smokey, like, just doesn't okay. do it.
Yeah. After a while, I mean, you got to do it.
Well, I had a piano teacher that was, you know, at the point where counterpoint became part of my studies. Bach was interesting and one of the godfathers of counterpoint. But when I brought in some sheet music for Boogie Woogie, he kind of glazed over and said, this is really complicated. And I said, well, watch. And I played some for him. And they said, oh, let's work on this. So I felt fortunate that I had parents that not only kind of pushed me in the conservatory, you know, rigors of conservatory, just reading the fly shit on the page, but I certainly was experimental, you know, speaking of Edelweiss. Back in the Rodgers and Hammerstein days and so on, and Henry Mancini, I would play those songs, but then in those songs, I would find chords and think, oh, these are great chords. These sound good, you know, all by them. Suddenly you start extrapolating some of the stuff that sounds good to you, and then you sequence them and say, well, that's a song, you know. So I get
what you take from it. You take from it what you want and leave the rest behind. Mm-hmm. That's how there's a chord that we use in the Smithereens all the time. I don't know what it's called. It's in variation of an F and a G or something. I don't know. But I discovered it because I was trying to figure out the opening chord of A Hard Day's Night.
Hard Day's Night. Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
And it was wrong, but we got, you know, I started using it.
Well, Dennis, what was it like doing that Nancy Sinatra record?
Oh, that was great. It was in Hoboken, of all places. It was a thrill because I always thought she was a great artist. I thought, like, her records with Lee Hazelwood and some other cuts by her that were a bit overlooked. I was thrilled to.
What year was that?
I think it was 04. And it's funny because Jarvis Cocker was producing one of the songs we worked on. And at the time, I had no idea who he was. And it was a good song and it was a good session. And I look back on it fondly. And I think that's a very good album, actually. It's a good artistic record she made there.
Do you read charts or you just go in and learn the song and play your own thing?
Yeah, I just heard it at the session and I played on two songs. And
cool.
Yeah. And we just went for it.
Awesome. And Ronnie Spector too, you played with her.
That was something else because you talk about influences and what certain music means to you. I mean, Be My Baby in the late summer of 63 really opened my mind, my ears and my mind to a whole new universe of possibilities. I at that point, I was definitely looking to play drums. I was just banging around on coffee cans at the time, but hearing Hal Blaine on that track and enveloped in all that reverb and it was a real moment. So getting to work with Ronnie was a real blessing. She was still very vital up until the end as an artist, and she was the real deal. And it was I never took every gig I got up on the drums and I never took it for granted. I always thought to myself, this is really a special gig, this is really cool. So yeah, I was very, very sad when she passed.
Yeah, her husband and son just came to see us two nights ago when we played in Connecticut.
Hmm. Awesome. Robin Wilson and Marshall Crenshaw, we've had both of those those guys on the show, and they had nothing but great things to say about Smithereens, obviously. But, man, talk about two great guys and two great guys to front your band. I mean, how did it end up that you found those two guys?
We
did you
are
just
lucky.
Know them or whatever?
We are lucky. We've known Marshall since 1980, 81. Around that time, we opened up for him somewhere and we became friends. And he actually played on some demos of ours in 1982 or something like that. And he played keyboards on our first album on Strangers We Meet.
Oh, really? Okay.
And baritone guitar on White Castle Blues. But he credited himself as Jerome on those records. So very few people knew that it was Marshall Crenshaw. So we kept in touch all this time. Robin Wilson, we had met in 1988 when we were going through Arizona. He wasn't in a band yet. He was a clerk at a record store called Zia Records in Tempe, Arizona, which we're playing next week in Tempe, Arizona with Robin Wilson. So that's going to be kind of cool. So he was there as a clerk. He set up the display for our Green Thoughts records. And there's pictures of us from when he was a teenager with long hair. Before Pat died, a couple of months before, we were booked to play the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. And after Pat died, it was suggested to us that we just do a tribute to Pat for that one, because the other ones we canceled, but this was local. So we called up everybody we knew. I got in touch with Bebe Buell. I don't know if you know who she is, but yeah, she. I know she did a version of Top of the Pops back in the 90s, and she just recorded Blood and Roses recently. So she came up from Nashville. We had I called up Peter Zaremba from the Fleshtones, an old friend of ours, to sing a song. Richard Barone from the Bongos. So we had a bunch of people singing different songs. We played like a 4-hour show. But so after the show, and it was wonderful, the crowd was great, everybody sang great. After the show, both Marshall and Robin said, if you want to ever do any shows in the future, I'm there. And they enjoyed it so much. So that's how that all came about, because we weren't really sure how we would continue, because we definitely didn't want a. I got a lot of messages from people saying, I sound just like Pat. And I'm like, no, that's not going to work for us. It could work for a band like Journey or something, but we're not going that route. And Marshall and Robin both bring their own thing into it. And that's what we want, you know. And then we also want to be able to continue with new material. So it's been working. That our fans are overwhelmingly supportive. And it's just been great. And we just played two nights ago.
I think it's cool how you guys are doing it, because Robin's still, he's still with the Gin Blossoms, obviously. Marshall still does his thing. I think that's kind of why it's working. You know, it's like people love those guys anyway. And if you're fans of those guys, then you're fans of the Smithereens anyway, right? So, but those guys were very complimentary of you guys from an influential standpoint. So we talked about Kurt Cobain earlier in the conversation, obviously. But, you know, there was a lot of guys in that generation that were clearly, you know, stealing things from the Smithereens. But I mean, it's cool to see you guys, you know, return that favor later and have those guys singing your songs. I mean, they make perfect sense is what I'm trying
to
say.
And I got to mention Susan Cowsill.
Oh yeah. Yeah. She is too. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
She's in the mix. I mean, we haven't been able to get together, but it would be great to have a female vocalist on those songs. So we are working on a song together also for the next album, because I met the Cowsills back in 1990 when we were recording the Blow Up album, and Dennis and I went to see, they were opening for the Screaming Trees and Red Cross. So during the show, I had just written a song called Now and Then. So I said to Dennis, I said, God, I have the background vocals in my head. We have to get the Cowsills to do the background vocals. So we go backstage after the show, we kind of worm our way back, and Susan didn't believe I was in the Smithereens. And I said, well, here's the number of the studio. Give them a call, because I think you guys would be perfect for this. And that's what happened. So we've been friends ever since. You know, who knows what's going to happen? People ask, are you going to have a permanent singer? And I said, nothing in life is permanent, you know? So we're just going to roll with the punches and move forward with however we can. We were always survivors. You know, my poor wife got pancreatic cancer, so it's going to be 7 years now. So she passed away. And, you know, she said to me, she said, we had 16 months, you know, to mull all this over. And she said, you know, you got to live your best life. She said to me, there are people out there that love you. They love your music, and you'll be fine. She's telling me I'll be fine, you know. So, you know, and I've been dating a wonderful woman now, you know, for a couple of years. And you know, this is life. It's just a continuation of life is what it is. And
yeah,
there you go.
Well, it's who you are, too. I mean, the band becomes who you are, but you're a musician and you're in a band and, you know, things change. And bravo to her for teeing that up for you, too. You know, that's awesome.
have a partner so generous and giving to, despite the potential of the woe is me aspect of being terminally ill, but to have someone who gives you a recipe, gives you a list of things that you need to do to carry on is pretty rare, man.
Well, we were teenagers when we met, and you know, we were together for, now I'm losing track, probably 39 years, you know, yeah. And my kids are in their 30s now, and wow. Yeah, so there you go. You got to keep going, and I'm trying to stay really healthy. I've been walking every day that I can, and you know, eating my fruits and vegetables.
Yeah. You know. Well, you mentioned that, and one the last time that I saw you guys with Pat was you guys were opening for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Yeah.
As I'm hearing you talk, recently I had the pleasure of seeing Mike Campbell in the Dirty Knobs, and he's out there kicking ass. I don't know if you've listened to any of his stuff.
Yeah, I have his albums on vinyl.
So good, man. And he's another guy that's just, you know, despite everything that he's been through with Tom and whatnot, I mean, he's soldiering on. And I listened to him, an interview not too long ago. He was talking about, you know, no, I want my band to be in the clubs. I want us to earn it. And they've been doing it, you know, and which is really cool to see. I think that's the right spirit for sure.
We're too old to change vocations at this point, right? I mean, kind of keep rocking. Mm-hmm. I'll be 63 on Friday. It's like, what am I going to do? Go back to college?
Yeah. As a songwriter, what do you enjoy most? Developing the chord sequence, the arrangement first, and then bringing words to it? Or do you ever find words as you're driving along that you need to put music to?
It varies. And that has happened in reverse, where I come up with a title and then try to write music to it. But most of the time it's a phrase or something that pops in my head. The hook is usually what pops in my head first, the chorus. And then it goes, then I got to figure out what kind of verse is going to go with this, you know? So that's usually how it happens. Music first. And on rare occasion, I did have lyrics first, which is an odd way to work, but I had for me. So I have done it both ways, but most of the time it's the melody and the hook.
Talking about an a cappella melody. You're not talking about something that came as a result.
No, it happens when I pick up the guitar and then I'll just strike some weird chord and then something in my brain will go off.
Your hooks are masterful, man. I mean, they suck you right into the song, everything that I've ever heard.
Well, thanks. I don't know if you heard, you know, the song Cut Flowers on our 11 album. I came up with that whole thing, but I had these placement lyrics in there, and Pat put some great lyrics on there so that was like a good collaboration, because my lyrics were horrible on that one. And it just came out. Oh, no, the point about that one was Mike listened to the demo and I had this opening riff. He said, that's two different songs. And I said, no. He said, well, you could make two songs out of that. And I said, no, Mike. I want this song to have as many hooks in it as possible, you know, and that was the way I felt back then. I try to put more than one or two hooks in a song, you know, you've got to. Oh, we had the Honeys sing the background vocals on that, on Cut Flowers. The Honeys, Marilyn Wilson.
Marilyn and her sister. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Diane.
And I remember when they came to the studio, Marilyn, she had a Mercedes and her license plate had it was a abbreviation of Good Vibrations, like GV, you know. And I said, I saw your license plate. And she said, yeah, that's the money I got for that song from Brian. I'm like, oh, my God. With all the bad luck that I've had a lot of good luck. I mean, a lot of people also don't know that I've been working a day job for 19 years.
So I was going to say something about that.
I kept it pretty much secret. I mean, it's not what happened. My neighbor across the street was in the Twin Towers when it was hit, 9/11. So he made it, you know, he was alive. I didn't know he was alive till 4 or 5 hours later because of all the mayhem that was going on. But a month after 9/11, it was October, he was walking his dog, and we weren't doing too well then. We had maybe 5 shows on the books, and I was joking with him, not joking again. You know, my wife was saying at the time, you know, you should really consider getting a job because you hardly have any shows and there's no royalties, nothing coming in. It was a real down period. So
My neighbor's walking his dog. And I said, oh, you know, Betty says I should get a job. And he said, you know what? Somebody just left and I could put you in. And I said, wait, I don't have a resume. I don't have any clothes. I'm like a t-shirt and jeans guy. And he says, don't worry about it. You know, we'll get you going. So I went out and bought some shirts and some shoes, you know. And I go in there and they have me filing and this and that. And then I learned how to do this and that. And then I stayed there for 19 years. It was a godsend because it was a steady income. I got to keep my house during that period. So health insurance, and then, you know, we built up, like with the Meet the Smithereens, when we got all that press, the New York Times, we started getting more gigs. And, so I was lucky that my neighbor was the senior VP because I got 6 weeks vacation. So I was able to record and tour.
Nice. But you have to isolate that musical activity to those 6 weeks, or do you get grace from them?
Yeah, I almost got fired during the Tom Petty thing because it was during quarter end and you're not allowed to take off from work. And I went above my boss's head to another boss and said, look, I'm going to be playing hockey arenas and place with Tom Petty. And my direct boss never heard of Tom Petty and doesn't know music at all. So, and I kind of kept quiet at work. I just sat in my cubicle, did my work. There were very few people that knew what I did. Some people knew that I was a musician, but they didn't know what to what capacity or whatever. And I liked that. I wanted to be anonymous. I just wanted to do my work. And there were times I'd come home from LA on a red eye, go into the parking lot, get in it sick, go to the parking lot, change my clothes and go to work. So it was rough. So, but anyway, it just ended during COVID because I was working at home and then they outsourced my job to India. And I was kind of glad because I'm going to be 65 in a month and I would have left anyway. But this way, they gave me a year severance and health insurance for a year. And now I'm going to go on Medicare. So kind of worked out.
Yeah.
When I say life got in the way with the Lost album and or my solo stuff or whatever, it's because I've been working a day job and the commute was 3.5 hours every day, like for both ways. It sucked, but I did it for my family.
Well, good for you, man. I mean, there's a lot of people that do that and have to do it or choose to do it. I know I have a good friend named Todd Johnston. I don't know if you know Todd. He's a drummer in the Georgia Satellites and has been for many years. And he, same thing for him, man, you know, and I mean, it is what it is, you know, and respect to you for doing what you got to do for your family first. I mean, that's
what kept me going, you know, my kids and my wife time. And you know, it was funny that my first office was across the street from Radio City. And I had played there with Lou Reed and with the Pretenders. And I'm looking outside the window. I'm like, God, what did I do with my life? You know what? We kept going. We kept going.
That's awesome. And good for you guys. And glad you did.
I have a friend and client and guitarist who works with the band Tiles. And his day job, every time I get a phone call from my caller ID says IRS. And I think, oh, fuck, really?
Oh, that's never one. Yeah.
And he works for the IRS. And and it's just use facilities management for the IRS. But
so if I ever get audited, can I get his number and maybe call off the dogs, man?
I don't want to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. We appreciate your time. Best of luck to you guys. Continued success.
Congratulations on everything you do.
Thank you.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.